The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
It's Friday, the end of another week, but more importantly, it's the 20th of December already. We are running into the last 11 days of 2013, a year that won't be missed by a lot of people. They're looking forward to 2014, even though that shows every sign of being more of the same and maybe a double helping. We'll find out. Tonight, the first hours, a special first 2 hours for you, kind of a Christmas gift. We're going to go down to New Zealand now, where I think it's tomorrow, Saturday, which proves that tomorrow will happen. And standing by is one of the most interesting people in the world of Mario Lanza, and that is an interesting world indeed. He has recently written a book called The One Tenor. We're going to talk about that. He has been around for many years. He is an extraordinary writer, tremendous background in talking to people, interviewing people, not only in the life of Mario Lanza directly and otherwise, but other people in the world of classical music as well. He is a remarkable man. His name is Lindsay, and the last name is P-E-R-I-G-O, one of the most mispronounced names in Lanza land. Are you there, Lenz?
I certainly am. Thank you, Jeff. Nice to be with you. When you say mispronounced, we mispronounce it ourselves. We say Perigo, when it should be Perigo. It is Portuguese, and it means danger. And as I sat listening to your opening music, I thought, my goodness, how scary. I'm not sure I'm scary enough to live up to it, but if I do, I'll be living up to my name. But normally it's Lindsay Perigo.
I've always pronounced it that way. And I will tell you that of all the people who have been involved with this whole Lanza legacy, Lindsay is certainly one of the most unique. He is at times extraordinarily humorous. I don't know if we'll hear a lot of that tonight, but he is a very, very wise and funny man in many ways. But his experience in dealing with this legacy, this legend, is extraordinary. When did you first stumble across the voice, Lindsay?
It wasn't so much a case of stumbling across it as seeking it out of curiosity, because one day in 1959, as an eight-year-old, I arrived home from school to find my mother on the doorstep crying her eyes out. I was really alarmed. I thought something must have happened to Dad, that she was really very upset.
And she was shattered.
She was, but of course I had no idea why. And then through the convulsions, she said, Mario Lanza died today. And that still meant nothing to me because I didn't know who he was, being a little eight-year-old and not particularly interested in music up to that time. Now, shortly after that, because of the obvious effect his death had on my mother, I made a point of going to one of Mario's movies that came to the little town of Fielding in the North Island in New Zealand, the Lower North Island. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'd better go and see what had Mum so bothered.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my parents were skeptical because they knew that this movie, The Great Caruso, was possibly a little advanced for an eight-year-old kid. But I was determined to see it. I went on my own as an eight-year-old. A different world, Jeff, where little kids can do that sort of thing on their own without parental
Indeed.
Supervision and no one's worried.
Indeed.
And I went, and honestly, it was, to use the cliche, it was life-changing, because I just came out of that cinema. You can probably hear me getting a bit emotional recalling the event, but I was in a different world from the one I was in when I entered that theater. The magnetism of the man that just radiated from the screen, I'm very much reminded of what Jose Carrera says about the same sort of thing at a similar age, the magnetism that was there, the way of talking that Mario had, that insouciance, and of course that glorious voice that poured forth through the big speakers in the theater. And it didn't matter to me that I understood very little of the arias in terms of what was being said, most of them being in Italian. I just loved the melody, the spectacle, everything about it, the sense of life, and above all, of course, Mario's performance. So,
let me add something to that. I wasn't able to see The Great Caruso until I was actually in college, and I had certainly heard the soundtrack and had listened, but it wasn't a film that you could easily get. And I did rent it on 16mm. format and played on a projector at one point, but to see it in the theater, and I'm just trying to put myself in your eight-year-old shoes and sitting in a chair and on a 25 or 30 foot tall screen with those enormous voice of the theater speakers. I saw that in college, and the place was packed. The entire theater was full. This was a Sunday afternoon, a revival kind of a thing, a special performance. After every song, every aria, those people stood up and applauded and cheered. And I had never seen anything like it. I couldn't believe it.
No, well, I noted with interest, Jeff, that in your chapter, the chapter you so kindly contributed to my book, you recall the first time you saw it on the big screen. And I hadn't realized up to then that it had been some time between when you saw it on television, I guess.
And
then saw it actually at the movies. It is a different experience, isn't it?
Oh,
I believe they put it out in 70mm at one point, but of course what that involved was a slowing down of the soundtrack, and I never saw it, but people who did said that the soundtrack did suffer because of the slowing down. You got a slight kind of wowing effect and a loss of vibrance. And of course in Europe and England, the VHS versions actually run a little fast.
Yes.
So you're in danger of getting that chipmunk sound. It's only for very sensitive ears who even notice these things. But it's one of the problems, you know, with Mario's movies and The Great Caruso in particular is that the sound quality of all the reproductions is just not good. And so that's why it was so interesting to get that Rhino CD from a few years back. I think we're going to play a track from it tonight, where they used a soundtrack material, and it was good, lovely, warm, and bassy, and yet still very vibrant at the top. And reminiscent of just what it was that so impressed us in the first place.
You know, and all the people that you have talked to over the years, and I had the privilege of knowing many that you know, and Al Teitelbaum was Mario's manager for a number of years, and he said that in every instance, the live voice was so much more impressive than any recording he ever heard. You've heard that.
Yeah, well, but it's hard to imagine, isn't it? You think, how could it be more impressive?
Yeah.
But I think where you do get a clue as to the truth of what Al said to you is in those snatches we have of his home recordings where he's warming up the voice.
Unbelievable.
And at one point, you know, he does an octave leap. I think he's on a B-flat. And it just makes this extraordinary sound, which fortunately is not compressed. So you get the full blast. It's as though you're in his living room with him. And there's that funny moment at the end where Colleen, who, what is she then, 3 or 4 years old, she's nearby and she... Mm-hmm. She starts to clap, and Mario says, thank you, my public.
I know.
You just wish that there was a lot more of that material, because I think there you do get an idea of the raw power of the voice that Sammy Cahn, the songwriter, described, where he said, do you remember he said that it's as though he had a loud pedal and a soft pedal in his throat, and the loud pedal, when he pressed on that, it scared the hell out of you, and he said no mechanical means could
replicate,
adequately reproduce.
Couldn't record it. I talked to Sammy as well, and we were talking about something else, and then I waited till the proper moment. And we're going to go through this, Brett. Thank you. I asked him, I said, well, Mario Lanza. And, of course, Sammy Cahn wrote some of the great songs, and he began to sing. One of them, and whenever he came to a high note in the song that he had written, he just pointed at the ceiling. He wouldn't sing it. He said, that was Lanza. He would just point. He says, I can't even dream of going there. And it was fun. He was, when I mentioned the name, it was almost as if I had slapped him, and he had gone back into a trance and just time-traveled back. And his eyes almost glazed over, and he said, oh, my God, what a voice that man had. Yes. They all said that.
Yes, and that we can't really get an idea from the recordings, as impressive as they are,
what it was
really like. And, of course, the testimony also of people who heard him in live concert, for example, at the Royal Albert Hall, which we do have a recording of, but I think we're not hearing it the way he actually sounded. The people who were there, people, real experts like Joan Sutherland and Richard Bonning and Nikolai Gedda, they just said exactly that. It's the most amazing sound I've ever heard. And it's, I guess there's nothing we can do about it now. We can't bring him back to say, okay, now we want to hear the real sound. And,
right.
And what we have, of course, is extraordinarily impressive and has been life-changing for so many people. I just wanted to ask you, since you raised Sammy Cahn, I think it was you who told me that Mario changed something in Because You're Mine at a rehearsal with Sammy. Is that am I getting that right?
That was with Albert Sendrie. Al Sendrie did the musical arrangement for over 140 or 150 MGM musicals. And Albert Sendrie worked with Mario on Because You're Mine. S-E-N-D-R-Y, for those of you listening. Albert Sendrie came from a European musical family. His father was a conductor. And he told me that when he got the music to Because You're Mine and played it, and actually I went to visit Albert Sendrie in his home, the same grand piano, the same home that Mario had gone to, and I was standing there, and he says, you're standing right where Mario did. And he said, I began to play, and Mario would sing Because You're Mine. And he said, I'd get to a certain point, and Mario would say, no, that's not right. It needs to be done this way. And he said, Mario was right. I changed it, and the song exploded. So it was Because You're Mine and Albert Sendrie. Although he may well have done the same thing with Sammy Cahn, I don't know. But Al told me that face to face, and it was quite an interesting moment.
Well, he was such a musician, even though he wasn't a trained musician and apparently didn't read music.
Isn't that amazing?
All that well, if
yeah.
at all. But
yeah.
you do hear of that, and I'm told Pavarotti didn't read music either, which is extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
But Mario just had this instinctive thing going on. It's really interesting where he's talking to Ray Heindorf, the conductor for the movie Serenade, and he's describing the process by which he became literate in the field of opera and classical singing, and he doesn't say it in as many words, but it's quite clear what he's getting at is that he never received formal training reading the musical stave and so mm-hmm. on, that all of that he doesn't even care about, and he gets on perfectly well without it. And it's akin to people I know who can just sit and play the piano with all the chords absolutely right and harmonies and so on. They don't read a note of music. Not only that, but if you say, no, I'd like it in a higher key, they can transpose it immediately.
I know.
That is miraculous. And I think Mario had that sort of innate musicality.
He did. He was gifted. It's just a fluke of the universe, a fluke of nature. Mm-hmm. Now, we have a playlist. Lindsay has sent me a list of songs that he'd like to play tonight. And we'll go ahead. And if you want to start, Linz, I don't know. We've got Silent Night from the Coke Show, which we could play and start things off because it is the Christmas season, if you'd like. Does that work?
I think that would definitely work, and you suggested Silent Night to me, and I said, why not play the Coke one, because it's not as well known as the commercially released one, which I guess will be out again this Christmas, when Mario's Christmas Carol recordings always seem to do quite well. But this one, of course, is lesser known because it's from his Coke radio show. We have it with introduction by Bill Baldwin. There's no chorus, but in some respects, I think vocally, Mario is actually better in this performance than in the commercial recording.
All right, let's take this one. We say Coke Show for you folks who don't know. Mario had his own radio program syndicated nationally, sponsored by Coca-Cola in 1951 and 52. We call them the Coke Shows. Here it is from the Coke Show. This is an old recording. And Silent Night, Mario Lanza.
Peaceful and calm, with majestic stars looking down. Shepherds crossing the fields of Galilee going to the manger. Such a night must have been that of the first Christmas. And of such a night, Mario Lanza now sings.
the dawn of redeeming grace. Jesus, love and life birth. Jesus, Lord at thy birth.
Okay, recorded in 1951 at the Radio Recorders Studios in Hollywood, California, and played on the Mario Lanza Coca-Cola show in 1951-1952, and out every year on CD, as is the case. Not this particular version. The RCA version is out, but this was played on the radio during Christmas time long ago. It's a standard and a classic, and I had not heard that for many, many years without there was a chorus in the RCA version. That was his record label, for those of you who don't know. And they used to do a lot of choral additions to his music over the years. Anything, Lindsay, you want to add to that one?
I was going to say, Jeff, I find it humorous to listen to him do Sleep in Heavenly Peace in the first verse, because in the commercial version he mucked it up trying to do it mezza voce, and he took a breath between the word heavenly and peace, and he was sharp on the he of heavenly and so on. Again, perhaps not a lot of people would notice, but he obviously did, and he corrected it that time, but he went at it full voice. And same with Jesus, Lord, at thy birth. That phrase, those two, da-da-dee-da-da-da, is one of the hardest phrases in all of music, and it sounds so simple, and it's just a Christmas carol. But
yeah, well, I know what you mean.
It's tough, and he'd obviously prepared that second time in the Coke Show recording. He said, I'm going to nail it this time, and he did.
Now, we have a number of things to play tonight. This is a, for those of you who don't know much about the Lanza legacy, Mario lived a very short life. He died when he was 38. There's still some controversy about that. But in a way, his career took a remarkable turn at its very peak in 1952. And we'll talk about that. Very interesting stories. Lindsay's book is available. We'll talk about that as well. It's online. It is called The One Tenor, and aptly named. And we'll be right back in just a couple. Okay, welcome back, and we are talking with Lindsay Perrigo about the great Lanza. And I think it does merit repeating that the voice was so big, so colorful, it was like the northern lights in a throat. My brother said that once, the colors, the remarkable brilliance, that engineers really didn't have to, they almost neglected to do, I won't say they didn't do their best, but they took it for granted. And in the mid-60s, or the mid-50s, there were compression things done, and it was just something, as you said earlier, in that home recording. And I know online there is a rehearsal of one of the arias. Which one is it?
Un Dia al Puro Spazio.
Well, that too, Lamento di Federico.
At Lamento di Federico.
It is see, you say it beautifully. Say that again.
Lamento di Federico.
All right, now you embarrass me. It is so huge that you just get the idea that this reel-to-reel tape recorder could have melted. And here he's just rumbling. George London, the great baritone, I think it was his son who said that when they would rehearse together, that when Mario would open up, the wall, the roof, the walls, the ceiling would vibrate. It was that big. Al Teitelbaum, told me the same thing. He said the house would actually shake. Not like an earthquake, but it would vibrate. So that's big. That's really big. We should do, and we'll go through the next break too, Brett. Thank you. The Christmas season. We're going to do one more Christmas season song, although this is not a carol. This is something very special. This is, of course, not done very often for obvious reasons. It is the Lord's Prayer. Mario first sang it on the radio in a public setting on the Edgar Bergen Charlie McCarthy program. You tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that was the late 40s, and I do have that. It was released by Damon Lanza Productions a few years back.
Yeah.
And that is truly a thrilling performance, but the one we've selected tonight, I think, is again from the Coke Show and has the distinction of being introduced by Mario himself. And I understand that, and I think this was quoted in Roland Bessette's biography of Lanza. One of the musicians in the orchestra said this performance, to hear it, to be present for the actual rendering of it, mm-hmm. it was, quote, earth-shaking, absolutely shattering, unquote. And when you hear Mario's climax, for thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever, amen, it is just that.
Right.
I guarantee you'll be speechless when it's finished, Jeff.
Yeah, we have that particular track is unfortunately in mine not available. I'm going to have to play the RCA, which is also wonderful, and I think people will get the same idea.
Indeed they will. But you must, for your own satisfaction, track that other one down and hear Mario introduce it himself, which he does very sweetly.
Yeah.
And the climax is truly astonishing. It's pretty good in the one you're about to play as well. But honestly, in the Coke Show one, you can see what the musician was talking about.
Very good. Okay, here we go.
forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory
Okay, did that come through all right, Lenz?
Certainly did. I was privileged about 5 years ago to listen to that with Daniel Rodriguez, you know of whom I speak, no doubt.
Oh, yes, yes. Uh-huh.
And he was visiting New Zealand. He was in my apartment, and naturally we were talking about tenors and the one tenor in particular, and I put on the Lord's Prayer, and naturally we were both just in tears. At the end, there's something to be said for listening to it, to something like that, with someone else who knows what he's hearing. And of course, in the case of Daniel, that is 100% the case.
Yes, indeed. He was known as the singing police officer, and has, I guess, quite a good career going for himself.
He does, and he's very generous in his tributes to Mario, and like a number of tenors currently on the scene, they've overcome the old-fashioned snobbery that they never had, but that used to exist in the opera world about Mario, and they fully embrace him. As Richard Leach said in his Chicago Park tribute, it's now cool to like Lanza again.
And what a nice thing to say. All the really great people in music who sing, who aren't snobs, who come to the realization that they are hearing something that transcends the old axiom, well, if you don't sing in the opera houses, you can't be an opera singer. Mario Lanza was much more than an opera singer. He was a singer of the universe, and he could sing anything. They call it crossover, but that really trivializes the talent. You heard the softness, and you know the technical terms for it in Silent Night, and then you just heard an extraordinary demonstration of vocal brilliance.
And again, he started softly, as he did in Silent Night, but the climactic bars were, well, you know, when he starts out, "For thine is the kingdom," you think, heck, is he going to make it through this? Because he's got a way to go yet, and he's got that big B flat at the end. And I mean, make it through, heck, with bells on. And you know, a purist might say, "Oh, but he's sharp on that last note after he aspirates the amen, amen." Yeah. And if you're of that mentality to worry about such things, then
well, you shouldn't be listening.
Knock yourself out. But honestly, as far as I'm concerned, Mario gets a free pass because it's just such a thrill, and nobody performs the climax to the Lord's Prayer, as Mario does it there.
I have, during that particular performance, been able to find the Coke Show version to which you alluded. So let's
just... Well, I thought
you must have it. I found it. It was buried in the back. Let's find it and get it out. I've got it queued now. I'm going to go ahead and play it, and we'll listen. Remember, this was done on radio. This was not in a recording studio. This was a radio recording, and here we go. So you tell us what you think.
Thank you. This is Mario Lanza again. Many composers have set to music the Lord's Prayer, but none perhaps has captured the essential dignity and beauty of the words as truly as Albert Hamelot. I would like to sing it for you now, and such is the sacred nature of the song that I feel sure our listening audience would prefer that there be no applause at its conclusion.
Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory.
As someone once said, how do you follow that? You're right, Lindsay. He went incandescent in the end of that.
Yeah, yes. He and hearing them back to back like that, which I wasn't expecting to do, makes it very apparent that in that performance from the Coke Show, he really has taken it to the next level. And you can see absolutely what the orchestra member meant when he said it was absolutely earth-shaking, shattering. Goodness me, I've got the goosebumps in my hair, the hair on my thighs standing on end. I'm sure you want to know that, Jeff.
I back of my neck too. It never ceases to amaze me. In producing my three CDs, I was able to get into the RCA vault and have the original tapes sent to New York, and then I hired a sound engineer, and we went through. And my God, if I'd have known what I know now, I would have had that taken off the master tapes. That needs to come off. There's some treasures in there. That's one of them.
Well, that most certainly is, and this is my frustration with the CDs that Sony, or what are they called now, TCM Sony, are putting out. They're really not using their imagination. Certainly that should be dug out. There's a massive number of things that ought to be seeing the light of day and ought to be being heard, and yet we just get the greatest hits over and over and over. And I'm delighted that The Toast of Hollywood, the new CD, is doing well, but please let there be a sequel where there is some genuinely new material, unreleased material, mm-hmm. and that right up there at the top of the list.
I would concur 100% and then some. Okay, now we have a situation where Mario sang English, as you know by now, and you're going to hear other things later on. But we probably have enough time to tell the story, and then we'll play the two examples right after the top of the hour. And what I'd like to do is ask Lindsay to set this up. Mario's career started with that Midnight Kiss in 1949, The Toast of New Orleans, a magnificent success in 1950, 1951, The Great Caruso. He wanted to go on and straight away make The Student Prince. MGM wanted him to make a Korean wartime soap opera film called Because You're Mine, and he didn't want to do it. And he did it, and he reported to work quite overweight. And it's fascinating because they say, and I was told the story personally by people who were there, that throughout the shooting of the motion picture, Because You're Mine, he kept losing weight and getting thinner and thinner. And finally he got so thin that he was too thin to shoot because the difference in his physical size was so enormous, and they had to wait until he put some weight back on so they could at least make him look healthy. He got down to 160 pounds or something, wasn't that it, Lenz?
Well, I tend to talk in kgs, but his weight over his adult life fluctuated from 120 kg at the top down to 76, which is extraordinary. And when you're doing that in a matter of weeks, which he did on these crash diets, the effect is astounding and, of course, absolutely, unbelievably deleterious to your system, your nervous disposition and everything. And it gets to the point, I argue in my book, that when you're looking for an explanation as to why did Mario's career go off the rails, you don't really have to look that far. And it is fundamentally in that crazy dieting that he did throughout his professional career. Those of us who go on a mild diet know how destabilizing it can be, but these were serious diets indeed, life-threatening actually in their magnitude. These days we know much more about the subject and would not let anybody do that without some kind of intervention. But that's what he did, and you're right, he did it through the course of that movie. You can see it in the scene where he goes into the chapel to sing the Lord's Prayer. When he goes in, he's svelte, skinny, absolute matinee idol material. When they shoot him on the other side of the door, he's enormous. He's a big tent. And obviously the scenes were shot at different times, and you can see it right there. And in one of the documentaries about him, they split the screen. And you've got big Mario on the left and svelte Mario on the right. And you think, my God, no one can do that to himself without potentially fatal consequences. And in Mario's case, they were literally fatal.
He was, in addition to being under stress, of course, all the time, very conscious of his weight. People would talk about it. That bothered him. He was, as you can tell by his singing, a man very deeply and profoundly in connection with his emotions, his passions. He was a simple man in that respect because he was almost a living raw nerve of incredible passion, hyper-passion about what he did. And when people would criticize him or take advantage of him or stab him in the back, it was devastating to him. And to soothe himself, he would drink, as many great artists do. But without that sensitivity, we wouldn't hear the kind of sound that we do in terms of being just off the scale. I mean, he put himself, everything he did, into it. That the story in Terry Robinson's book about the emotional after effects of one particular song that he sang were quite interesting. But he would go into the corner of the studio after recording a song, and this was told to me by two different people. I'm sure you heard the same story. And he would sit. He would just go and sit by himself. He was so spent. He would just go and sit and be still. And it's every time he sang in the studio, apparently the entire orchestra virtually would stand up and applaud. They were just amazed.
Well, you'd be spellbound and dumbfounded. I think Mario himself said, or someone said it of him, that each time he sang, a little part of him died, simply because he put so much into it. And as you know, he said often, "I sing each word as though it were my last on earth." And it must have been, and this is part of what contributed to his demise, I'm sure, it must have been utterly incomprehensible to him that he would be panned for adopting that approach, for being over-emotional. And coming back to the story you were leading up to about the two recordings of Beloved for the Student Prince, that's exactly what happened. He recorded the song Beloved for the movie The Student Prince, a song that was written especially for the movie. It's not part of Sigmund Romberg's...
It's a beautiful song, by the way.
Beautiful song. And the director, Curtis Bernhardt, who fits the description of Prussian pickle, which line occurs in the movie, told him that it was over-emotional and he would have to do it again. And that, for Mario, was the last straw. He'd already had some run-ins with this director, and I think it was already obvious to Mario, to Bernhardt, to everybody, that they were chalk and cheese. But when he said, "You'll have to do it again..."
Too much passion. Yeah, no Prussian Prince. No Prince sings like that.
Yeah. And if you're Mario, you must contemplate that and think, what the heck? What sort of world is this? And do you want me to tell the whole story now, or are we waiting?
We have to take a break here in just a minute, but I hear the music, so that means time for a pause. Yes, we'll tell the story when we come back. And what we'll do, remember, Mario recorded the soundtrack for the film, The Student Prince, essentially in all one takes. One take, one take, one take. There were one or two that he did over, but he was that on and that enamored of the music that it was, again, a definitive performance. And when he reported for the filming, and the music is already in the can, and the director said, too much passion, you have to do that track over again. And I think the words that Lanza uttered were, those that I can repeat here, were, you can direct my acting, but you don't touch my singing.
Don't tell me how to sing. Tell me how to act, by all means, but don't presume to tell me how to sing.
Yeah.
And furthermore, I mean, Mario was correct in the context of the movie. When he explained it himself, and when you see the movie, you understand the point. This is the point where the prince, the student prince, makes the transition from being a Prussian pickle himself into being a daredevil, hell-raising lover who's prepared to conduct his affair with a barmaid, not someone else from royalty, but a barmaid, with a reckless abandon. So, you know, that's some transition. And Mario put it all into that song. But Bernhardt was just judging it, I think, on the merits of the thing as a piece of music, and one shouldn't sing as emotionally as that. That is too emotional. You will not sing with that emotion.
Exactly.
So it is.
Well, we'll tell the rest of the story in just a couple minutes and play you the version that was recorded by Mario for the film, and then the version that he had to go back and redo for the film to placate Bernhardt and the studio, MGM, which ultimately led to his permanently walking off the set and then making the movie with another actor lip-syncing the recorded soundtrack that Mario did. And then some years ago, when we finally got that original recording of Beloved from the MGM vaults, it vindicated Mario 100 times over. He was right in the way he did it. And that's just the way it is. So hold on, we'll come right back with more in just a few minutes. Glad you're along tonight. Okay, and let's get right back to our special guest, Lindsay Perigo, coming to us from New Zealand. All right, Lindsay, tell us the rest of the story They had the conflict. Mario walked out. He had already recorded the soundtrack for The Student Prince. The motion picture was made with another actor. I've never seen it. I won't watch it. The album itself, of course, went off to sell over 1 million copies in LP. The movie bombed. Tell us the rest of the story.
Well, the story was that having recorded the song and been told by the director, Curtis Bernhardt, that the recording was too emotional, he'd have to do it again, Mario stormed off. Then a war of attrition went on for several months, and that's when Mario was not able to do any other work because of his contract with MGM. If a conflict like this arose, if circumstances like these occurred, he couldn't do anything else. And that even put the kibosh on his radio show, from which we've just been hearing such memorable extracts. Finally, an agreement was reached. Mario would go along with the arrangement whereby another actor lip-synced to his recordings. He would go in and record the song Beloved again and do it in a more seemly fashion. And so, as you say, it's only a few years ago, a few short years ago, that the offending version, the original version that the director objected to, was released for us all to hear. And then we could listen for ourselves and decide who was right. Now, I have to say, when that first came out, my conclusion was, no, Curtis Bernhardt was correct. He should have made Mario do it again. Mario was wrong. It was too emotional. And it certainly is conspicuously more emotional than the final version that Mario did. But then I just kept listening, and all the time bearing in mind the context of the plot and Mario's own interpretation. And, you know, it grew on me, the original wild version that he had to re-record, until it got to the point where I preferred the original and concluded that no, Mario was right after all. And it was really interesting for me to introduce both versions to someone who knew nothing of the background. And funnily enough, this was a young man, Jeff, in Portland, Oregon. And he became quite a Mario fan, and I played him the two versions, not giving him the elaborate explanation that we've just given the listeners out there. He didn't know any of that. And I said, which of these do you prefer? And he said he preferred easily the wild version, the original version, the one that Mario had to redo. And he was a musically literate, sensitive person whose judgment I respected. So without knowing any of the background and without having any one of the two versions in his ear, as we did, of course, because we all those years had the tame version, he alighted immediately on the more emotional of the two. And I guess what we're about to do is let listeners make up their minds. But it got to the point where, I mean, I would have to say the re-recording is an exemplary piece of singing. It is magnificent. And in some ways, technically, it is superior. The vocal line absolutely never falters. In the original emotional version, it is a bit choppy. But that is really of little moment in the overall impact of that original recording. I find it now, I don't bother listening to the more restrained version, even though it is excellent, because I get much more of a buzz from the original verboten.
I agree. It also fit the actual plot twist of the character in that film perfectly. So Mario was exact. All right, here we go. Let's listen. This is the released version that appeared in the motion picture soundtrack and on the LP that sold well over 1 million.
Was just a masquerade. Tomorrow just another day. Let come whatever, tonight or never, I'll throw the mask away. Beloved, with all my heart I love you. With every breath I pray, so above you are jealous of the way your eyes sparkle and shine day after day nearer apart. I try to say be still to my trembling heart, but though I may, I cannot hide this passion inside that won't be denied. If this be madness, then call it madness. I only know I'll never rest. I tell you, from now until the last bright star fades from the blue, now and forever, whatever I do, beloved, I love you.
Okay, Lindsay, a word or two, and I'll cue up the...
Beautiful love,
your all right, that's the next one. Lindsay, I'm going to cue the rogue version of...
Yeah, the rogue version. That's a good way of putting it.
Rogue version. And we'll hear that in just a second.
It must seem a bit strange that we would say what we've just been listening to is tame. But when you compare it with what we're about to hear... It is. This, what we're about to hear is the original so-called over-emotional rendering of the song.
Yep. Yeah.
As I say, the singing in the version we just heard is absolutely exemplary, and there are things that Mario does wrong in the version we're about to hear, but really they're of no moment, as I say, in the overall impact. But I would listen in particular in this version, Jeff, for when he gets to, but try though I may, I cannot hide this passion inside. The way he delivers those lyrics, and when he sings now and forever, whatever I do, mm-hmm. those are absolute stunners, and he doesn't quite get to moments like that in the version we've just heard. So here he is. He's really about to let rip. Rogue, yes, that's a good word. Naughty, actually, is another, especially in the opening bars, and I won't be more specific than that,
okay.
But it should be quite apparent what I'm talking about.
All right, here we go.
Was just a masquerade. Tomorrow just another day. Let come whatever, tonight or never, I'll throw the mask away. Beloved, with all my heart I love you. Every
every breath I pray, someday you will be mine. Summer or spring, winter or fall, you are my life, my love, my stars above you are jealous of the way your eyes sparkle and shine day after day, nearer apart. I try to say, be still, my trembling heart. Why, though I may, I cannot hide this passion inside that won't be denied. If this be madness, then call it madness. I only know rest till you are mine, beloved. Believe me when I tell you, from now until the last.
Well, I don't know what to say, except if you don't get goosebumps from that, you're not above room temperature. That just does not get any more passionate and sensual, and you can call it whatever you want. It's visceral. It's
I think Jeff, we should call it what it is. It's sexual.
Thank you.
It's unabashedly sexual. You know, I was fascinated to hear your interview with Noel Till, the Wagnerian bass, a few months back.
Yeah.
And he was speaking of the CDs, your own CDs, Mario CDs that you'd sent him, and he said that he'd listened to as much as his heart and libido could take. And that's it. It's libido. He sang sexually, and I don't doubt that was the reason that Curtis Bernhardt and all the people of that ilk dismissed him, because he was so overtly passionate in every sense of the term, not just spiritually, but with his body. He threw his whole body, not just his voice, into his singing. I mean, there was not a fiber of his being that was not involved with every word. So when he said, "I sing each word as though it were my last on earth," he wasn't making that up. That wasn't a cute line. That's really what he was doing.
We're going to move ahead, and that's summed up perfectly. We're going to play from the great Caruso, Vesti la Giubba. Mario referred to Vesti la Giubba from I Pagliacci by Leon Cavallo as his lucky song, if I'm correct in that. And it was something he always went to. There are four distinct versions on the internet, comparisons of them, and it's very interesting, from 1949 to 1959, I believe, and they're all different, but they're all amazing. So let's try and cue up Vesti la Giubba, which means, Lindsay?
On with the motley. Let's carry on with this charade, this awful show, whereby we're enacting on stage something that's going on in real life. Es Arlequin tin vola Colombina. If Arlequin goes off with Colombina, then just laugh and the audience will continue to applaud. When Mario gets to the words "Aunun applaudira," everyone will applaud. Just listen to the bitter irony in his voice. And this version you're about to play, you say it's from The Great Caruso, but actually it's an alternate take recorded for The Great Caruso. It's not mm-hmm. the one used in the movie, but yes. it is better. And this, in my book, The One Tenor, there's an article called "Which Vesti is Bestie?" and this is the one I nominate, because his attention to the lyrics, his dramatization of the meaning of the aria is absolutely flawless. And once again, the total passion that is involved. So for that reason, and the fact that he's in such excellent voice, the voice is really supple and colorful. Many people prefer the last version he did in the year before he died, 1958, in his last movie for the first time. But the voice doesn't have the suppleness, as far as I'm concerned, in that version that it does here. This is really tremendous.
All right, here we go.
Eppure tu papà, sforzati, va, se tu forse l'amma. Tu sei pagliaccio. La giubba, la faccia infarina, la gente paga e rider vuole cuore, se l'alchil di nuova colombina, ridi paglia.
Extraordinary, and I don't know what we can say about that hasn't already been said, but it's an aria that is very popular, very well known, and he did make it his own in so many ways. Now that is an alternate take, which was not in the movie, but they're both good, very good.
Oh yes, the version in the movie is very good, and until I heard that one, the version in the movie was my favorite. But then when the Rhino CD came out, and a lot of those tracks on there, Jeff, even though they were touted as being from the original soundtracks, they were recorded on those occasions, but they were alternate takes.
Yeah,
it was absolutely fascinating.
The Celeste Aida, for example, was not the one in there.
Indeed. Yeah. Actually, the recitative is the same. But when the aria starts, it's a different take.
I know,
and
it's funny.
Fell off my chair when I first heard that. And again, I think that the version on the Rhino CD is better than the one they used in the movie. And I scratch my head sometimes thinking, why did they do what they did? Why did they make the choices that they did? You can hear little things going on, maybe intrusive noises from people in the orchestra or something in the Celeste Aida, that maybe that was the reason they didn't use that take. But my goodness, the singing was absolutely extraordinary.
Well, and we also should point out that the man's face when he sang that aria, the first time a close-up of that magnitude, I think, was put before the public, his face was absolutely magical. I've never seen a face on the big screen evoke such a response from the audience, and constant fluid emotion rolling across the face. Just amazing.
Well, that was part of the impact that he had on me as an 8 or 9 year old going to see the great Caruso. They could have turned the sound off. I would still have been captivated.
Mesmerized.
It's going mesmerizing, exactly the word. Yeah. Funnily enough, you know, I watched The Great Caruso recently with a singing student here, just 21 years old, and he hadn't seen it before, and he too was captivated, but when it was over, I said to him, you know, it's funny, I've seen this thing probably literally a million times, and I still find it mesmerizing, exactly that word. As I say, they could have turned the sound off, and I would still have been mesmerized.
That's a good point.
With the sound, there is a considerable bonus.
Indeed. All right. I want to make sure we get as much in as we can. We have a little over 30 minutes to go. We can go to All the Things You Are, or we can move on to Que Jolie de Manina. What would you like to do next?
I think we should really make sure that we get the Que Jolie de Manina in, because it was from Mario's very first recording session on May 5th. It was. And he did four numbers on that occasion. And the story of the recording is told in some detail by his conductor, Constantine Kalinicus. And there's an interview that I did with Kalinicus, which is available on YouTube if people just type in Perigo Kalinicus, C-A-L-L-I-N-I-C-O-S. And Costa, as we called him, when I interviewed him, he recalled that occasion where they did those first four songs, and he was a substitute conductor for Jean-Paul Morel, with whom Mario had a fight, because Morel was correcting Mario just about every bar, saying, no, that's wrong, you held that note too long, and that was too short, and so on and so forth. And Mario just couldn't tolerate that. But Costa was somehow able to accommodate all of Mario's foibles, and together they worked to produce magnificent music.
Much like Louis B. Mayer, he knew how to handle Lanza.
Opposed to Dori Shari, who was in the ascendant at the time all that student-prince kerfuffle occurred. And it was just, you know, a different approach that achieved entirely different results. Dori Shari effectively destroyed Mario's career. I mean, there were many high points after that, but the low points kept getting lower, culminating in Mario's untimely death. And Jean-Paul Morel saying, oh, well, you've got to hold that note less long or longer. You know, those are things that the conductor should accommodate. The conductor should follow the soloist, not the other way around. And Kalinicus was prepared to adapt to Mario. And when they did that first recording, the Que Jolie de Manina, it's the only time I know of, and people are willing to correct me if I'm wrong, where Mario didn't really pay attention to the lyrics. He doesn't make of the words what he normally does, and indeed did in his Coke recording of it. All he's focusing on is just making a continuous line of sound that doesn't break. And when he starts out, it's very intense, and you think, my goodness, can he keep this up? And, of course, he does. It's astonishing. But if you, having heard me just say that, now pay attention to the way he sings. It's like an obbligato, a thing that an instrumentalist would do, where you've got just to hold the line, literally. Of course, all the passion is there, but he's not achieving it on this occasion and this occasion only. He's not achieving it by his unique way with words. The words are almost irrelevant. It's just this continuous line of unbroken, magnificent, glorious sound. These are sounds such as you'll never hear again. And afterwards you think, lyrics? What lyrics?
Exactly.
And Costa recalled the time when they got to Talor del mio forziere. You can hardly hear the word, certainly not that clearly, but my goodness, what a sound. And that phrase, over and over again, I used to play it, just it's just so beautifully conceived and executed. And so that, and apparently also Mario closed his eyes during the recording, which
I'm
was
not
very
surprised.
Poor old Costa.
He became part of the music. He was the music.
He was the music. This is a spiritual experience.
Per sogni e per
Voted by RCA, I believe it was the recording of the year in 1949, was it not? Hall of Fame, anyway.
Well, Costa described it as the International Critics Circle in Europe. I've never been able to track it down, but it got some kind of award for recordings of Kejeli Damanina in particular, and that one scored over Jussi Björling, and that's what Costa was at pains to point out to me. And, of course, Mario and Jussi were great mutual admirers. They were quite different in their musical approaches, and that possibly is the reason each admired the other so much. Jussi had the utter technical flawlessness that eluded Mario. Mario certainly had the passion that might have eluded Jussi, or that Jussi would have envied when he heard it. But two great singers. I hope that apocryphal story, well, I say apocryphal, what I'm saying is I hope it's not apocryphal, the story of the two of them getting together and listening to each other's recordings and getting drunk on Shivas Regal, and Jussi having to be carted off. Terry Robinson tells that story, and he told it to me on air. Funnily enough, the same show that you appeared on with me. I hope it's true, because if it isn't, it ought to be.
Yes, well, we'll leave it as it is then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next up, we've got time for maybe four more. We can do... Now, he sang popular songs sometimes as if they were operatic arias. And certainly, If I Loved You is one such example. He put himself into it. And this is a Rodgers and Hammerstein song from, I believe, Showboat, is it not?
Carousel.
Carousel. 1956 was the film version. And that would be one we might listen to next, if you'd like.
Well, absolutely, and this is one, if you've got the version lined up, I think you have, that Mario introduces himself. Here again, I'd like to put a plea out to Sony PCM, who've released this on the new CD, but without Mario's introduction. Why? It's a beautiful introduction.
I don't understand. Now, I previewed these, and my set is full of noise, and I just don't want to do that. It's snaps and crackles and pops, and I think it does a detriment to it. It's not a good. These were seemingly homemade CDs. I don't understand them back in the day, but I've got the RCA version, which is plenty good.
Okay, so that doesn't have Mario's spoken introduction. Let me just say what Mario does in the introduction is say that he's often asked which is his favorite Rodgers and Hammerstein number, and he nominates this one, If I Loved You, comparing it to the music of Brahms. And as I say in my review of the Toast of Hollywood CD, he proceeds to sing with appropriate lyricism and grandeur the mm-hmm. song that otherwise could be so ordinary, but just at the end when he transposes, when he gets to the words, "Soon you'd leave me," the second time round.
Mm-hmm.
He stays on the same note, which ordinarily would be the second note of the scale. Correct me or stop me if I'm getting too technical, but on Pass Me By, he stays on the same note for Soon You'd Leave Me, which effectively takes the melody a whole tone higher up. And then he has to tackle the Never, Never to Know at the very end.
I don't know how to talk about gymnastics. Yeah.
Yeah.
Super, superhuman moves vocally.
Superhuman is exactly the term.
Yeah. All right. Here we go.
If I loved you, time and again I would try to say all I'd want you to know. If I loved you,
wouldn't come in an easy way. Round in circles I'd go. Longing to tell you, but afraid and shy, I'd let my golden chances pass me by. Soon you'd leave me. Off you would go in the mist of day. Never to know. I loved you. If I loved you, but afraid and shy, I'd let my golden chances pass me by. Soon you'd leave me. Off you would go in the mist of day. Never to know.
Okay, and there we go. Now that was extraordinary. I don't know why. You really run out of words to try to describe the sound that came out of this man. It came from the bottom of his feet all the way up through and out the top of his head.
The top of my head to the tip of my toes, as he used to say himself, and every note as though it were my last on earth. I think part of the secret is not just singing notes, but singing the words, feeling the words, thinking about the meaning of the words. And it's a funny thing. Recently, I was at a masterclass conducted by Simon O'Neill, who's the foremost Wagnerian tenor of our time. He's a New Zealander, and he wrote the foreword for my book, or one of the two forewords for my book. My book boasts two forewords, and he wrote one of them. And he was back in Wellington recently, Wellington being New Zealand's capital, and he conducted a masterclass at Victoria University. And I went along, and it was just as though he was taking his cue 100% from Mario himself and insisting, nagging almost the singers to bring the words to life, because they were all a bit nervous and a bit, dare I say, stuffy. And just worried about keeping that vocal line going, and they were afraid of showing emotion. And he was trying to drag it out of them. And at one point, he cited in one of the songs the German word Glanz, G-L-A-N-Z occurred, and he said, no, Glanz, hitting those consonants, Glanz. He said, if Gili and Lanza can do it, so can you. He, as a tenor, he understands the nature of Mario's appeal and the universal imperative that it imposes on singers. Singers, you've got something other instrumentalists don't have. You've got lyrics, you've got words. So you don't just make notes. You sing the words, you feel the words, you bring them to life. And it was very gratifying for me to hear Simon introducing this concept, which in some cases was rather novel, to these youngsters who aspire to be singers, that they've got to get over the obsession with note perfection. It doesn't matter if the odd note is off, but emote.
It doesn't matter if the odd note is off. Correct. Technical perfection is not what emotional communication and genius is all about. It doesn't have to be there. Now, we have, let's see, we have about 9 minutes left, and I want to make sure I can play as much as we can. I've got room for two more, I think, with your wonderful introductions. Let's see where we go. I do want to end up, I do want to end with I'll Walk with God.
Okay.
And we have Passion, we have Nessun Dorma, we could duck in Make Believe, which wasn't heard for a long time until I fortunately got it out of the vault.
Yes, that's one of the outstanding selections on your CDs, and I must say the reproduction is glorious. But he does that so beautifully. Couldn't you, couldn't I, couldn't we? The way he does those lyrics, everyone else is going, couldn't you, couldn't I, couldn't we? But he's thinking, no, stuff that. I know that's what the rhythm might say, but I'm singing these words. Couldn't you, couldn't I, couldn't we? So, I mean, it was great to hear that. So by all means, go ahead with that. I guess it's about time you played one of your choices, Jeff, instead of one of mine.
It's okay. Let me... I have to find it here. Okay, here it is. I've got CDs all over the desk. Okay, there we go. All right, this is from Showboat. And this is Make Believe. And listen to the, since he's telling it straight. He's not play acting. He means it. Hope I've got this right. Let's see.
We could make believe I love you. Only make believe that you love me. Others find peace of mind in pretending. Couldn't you? Couldn't I? Couldn't we make believe our lips are blending in a phantom kiss or two or three? To tell the truth, I do. Others find peace of mind in pretending. Couldn't you, couldn't I, couldn't we? To tell the truth.
And he meant it.
For to tell the truth, I do. Yes, he sure did mean it, unmistakably. My introduction to that song was in a live performance by the Wellington Operatic Society, and the tenor, Gaylord Ravenel, who sang that song in that production, was a fellow called Robin Dumbbell, a rather unprepossessing name, but was no Dumbbell. And he had heard Mario live when he, Robin, was part of the George Mitchell Minstrels. He'd appeared the same occasion that Mario appeared at the London Palladium. And he'd gone along, and he was a bit skeptical, as young singers tended to be. Oh, Mario Lanza, just a movie singer, small voice, can't really sing. Yeah. And he said they were all, he said, our jaws dropped to the floor at the sounds we were hearing. He was just extraordinary. And Robin told that story often at my request when I wanted to reinforce Mario's credentials as a, you know, a singer who should be taken seriously.
Robin
was a serious singer, and he was the first to say this was greatness.
It was indeed. What's interesting is those recordings were almost all made with the classic RCA 44BX ribbon velocity microphone, which was around for decades and is still in use today. It's a classic. And I have one on my desk, which I am speaking into right now. It's a remarkable instrument.
I dare say it is, but I have to say, with all due respect, it doesn't make it, sound like Mario.
It didn't work. I didn't get the Lanza model. All right, Lindsay, would you introduce our last selection for tonight? We have just about enough time to get it in. I'll Walk with God. Just give us about 30 seconds on that.
Well, this, again, was written especially for the movie. It's not part of Sigmund Romberg's score.
The Student Prince.
It was recorded with organ only. And again, my plea to Sony TCM, let us hear that, please. Put it out with just the organ. We don't need the whole orchestra, but we'll settle for that right now. And this is one of Mario's most glorious pieces of singing, finishing off with a ringing B-flat. I can't think of a more appropriate way to end our tribute to someone who was, if not God, he was superhuman.
I walk with God from this day on. His helping hand I lean upon. This is my prayer, my humble plea. May the Lord be ever with me. No death, though eyes grow dim, there is no fear when I'm near to him. I lean on him forever, and he'll forsake.
I'll talk with God.
Well, Lindsay, thank you for being here tonight. That was an extraordinary performance. And I just can't even imagine. I mean, we who get to listen to this and understand it, I can't imagine those, and I've always felt that those who can't hear this are really missing out on one of life's most amazing experiences. And it's just something that you either get or you don't get.
Well, to not get it would be a most unfortunate affliction. I think many people are capable of getting it, but they're not yet introduced to it. I hope that shows such as you and I just did, and things like your website, your Mario Lanza forum, and my book, The One Tenor, which people can find by going to Amazon, all will help in introducing this beyond extraordinary voice to the world and uplifting the spirit, the spirits of our time. I mean, listening to your news bulletins at the top of the hour, my goodness, it's all gloom and doom.
Oh, yes.
And your magnificent, beloved country is going down the path of totalitarianism. It's awful to behold. But something like the influence of Mario can arrest such things and make people attune to the positive, the life-affirming, the life-embracing, just as he was.
Indeed. Very beautifully said. Thank you, Lindsay. It's great to share time with you. We'll do it again sometime.
I hope so. It was more than a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Be well. All right. That's our little Christmas card to you. And we will pause now and come right back.